7. The Lake of Fire. The fiery glow is visible for miles. Haley considers the possibility that saboteurs have taken out another tank farm despite the deployment of National Guard troops. She witnessed evidence of the military intervention soon after leaving the Tex-Mex Cafe in Sierra Blanca. A column of Humvees rolling west. The thump of helicopters overhead unseen in the night sky. Dozens of military 6x6 trucks transporting supplies. Soldiers with M16 rifles standing guard on overpasses, in rest stop parking lots, or watching from the back of 5-ton troop haulers. The conflagration's glow increases in size as she drives east on the interstate. Reeves County Sheriff's deputies direct traffic on the interstate, allowing civilian vehicles to continue in both directions but at reduced speeds. Seeing the uniformed deputies standing beside their department SUVs, Haley thinks of the cowboy handsome Gorditas loving Elmore Leonard fan she left back in Sierra Blanca. She had felt that surge within her and silently upbraids herself. What the hell's wrong with you? Pregnant by another man and on an operation to expose an imminent threat of potentially national proportions, and she entertains all new amorous thoughts? She dismisses the inclination quickly enough, gone moments after it abruptly appeared. But even if the notion was only a blip, the deeper state operative can't quite believe the ill discipline of her inclinations. Black smoke intermittently obscures the road ahead. So surreal. Otherworldly. Haley is not drawn here by the fire, but in pursuit of her quarry. Andrew Wilde's sources suggested that Nathaniel Culberson is in the area. But what exactly is a blaze? She sees a cluster of National Guard soldiers standing at the top of an off-ramp, cast in a sickly yellow glow by the overhead streetlight. The turnoff for Balmoray. In the most recent run-up of oil prices, peaking in 2019, the region, somewhat south of the more bountiful Permian Basin, proved a productive terrain for fracking. A significant percentage of those newly developed wells were abandoned after the market's collapse in 2020. With the Trans-Pecos pipeline traversing the region on its path to Mexico, though, targets for would-be saboteurs are abundant. Haley steers her rental car off the interstate and stops at the end of the off-ramp. Haley rolls down her window as a corporal approaches the car. His sandy hair frames a round, sunburned face that is far from friendly.
"You can't be here! Gotta get back on the highway!"
The corporal indicates the on-ramp entrance across the road. Haley has her identification, prepared by the deeper state within hours of her mission assignment, ready. "My name is Haley Chill. I'm an aide for U.S. Senator Gordon Powell on the Armed Services Committee." The National Guard corporal doesn't bother looking at the identification she proffers. His expression is stone. Haley tries again.
"I'm here on official business, Corporal. I'm looking for a Major Nathaniel Culberson, 72nd Brigade."
The guardsman sneers and turns his head to spit. Haley notices that the other soldiers have surrounded her vehicle, their weapons held at ready. One of the guardsmen uses a powerful flashlight to illuminate the car's interior. Haley shields her eyes from its bright white beam. Black smoke wafting across the roadway fills the car with its dank chemical odor.
"Park over there."
The corporal points to the shoulder of the road that passes over the interstate.
"Corporal?"
Haley hasn't a clue what the guardsman intends to do with her. He gestures again, impatient and hostile.
"Over there! Get this vehicle off the ramp!"
Haley does as she's told. The military is in control, not civilian authorities. Customary laws no longer apply. She opts to leave the Warhawk locked up in the trunk. She rejoins the soldiers grouped under the streetlight. None of the guardsmen look toward her, conversing among themselves as if the deeper state operative isn't even there. Haley gets the impression, though, that a vehicle is coming for her. She welcomes their casual disregard. After 10 minutes of waiting, a Humvee approaches from town and stops beside the soldiers standing on the top of the off-ramp. The corporal, silently, menacingly, points at the military vehicle. As Haley clambers into the Humvee, she hears lewd snickering from the men behind her. Inside the troop carrier, armed guardsmen stare at her with blatant hostility.
"You at the fucking New York Times?"
the private behind the wheel asks as he makes a U-turn and heads back toward town, 2 miles to the south.
No.
Haley feels no need to explain herself to the guardsman. She assumes that moment will come soon enough with someone of higher rank.
Barely satisfied, he says, "Too many fucking journalists around here, if you ask me."
The soldier riding shotgun ignores Haley entirely. He says to the driver, "They caught a dozen more of those fuckers coming over the border 2 hours ago at Hackberry Arroyo. My buddy said they had 50 pounds of plastic explosives on them."
Motherfuckers.
Through the windshield, just beyond the town ahead, the fire's glow fills the sky. Acrid smoke hovers at ground level, heavy with particulates. Balmoray is decidedly rural. Many residents on the town's dozen or so streets keep pens for horses and goats. Less than 250 acres in size, the town is home to 612 souls. Passing the darkened post office and the 11 Inn, taken over by the National Guard troops, the Humvee turns left on Galveston, right on First Street, and then stops in front of the mostly dark high school.
Haley isn't sure what the soldiers expect of her. "Go on, get inside, sunshine."
The driver gestures toward the school's front entrance. 2 soldiers holding M16s stand guard at the door. Inside a classroom next to the building entrance, Haley finds a chaotic scene. Local officials, including authorities from the Texas Railroad Commission and Reeves County Fire, argue for access to the fire site and are met with stony indifference by the military officers. Within seconds, Haley comprehends the reality of her situation. The soldiers didn't bring her here to meet with Major Culberson. The Texas Army National Guard lieutenants tangling with the incensed civilian authorities are flak catchers. She's been sidelined. For the moment, the 3 officers arguing with the civilian authorities ignore Haley. She backtracks out of the classroom and retreats up the dark corridor, avoiding the soldiers standing sentry at the school's entrance. The deeper state operative finds a door leading to the school's athletic field, but it's chained shut. Entering an empty classroom next to the exit, Haley goes to one of the windows, discovering it opens just wide enough for her to slip through and outside. Sulfurous fumes drift from south of the high school campus, bringing tears to her eyes. Thick clouds of churning smoke reflect the fire's glow to the ground and cast the scene in a ghoulish light. Heading in that direction, Haley jogs past a collection of storage sheds and across the bedraggled football field, then hops over a low fence on the other side. She traverses the 4 blocks of residential streets of mobile homes, chicken coops, and empty lots at a steady run. Crossing Railroad Avenue, Haley finds herself in open ground. Like the surrounding thousands of square miles, it is a desert landscape of switchgrass, lotebush, and mesquite. Everywhere there is the chemical smell of petrol extraction. She calculates the fire to be less than 2 miles away, south of her location. A road to the east leads in that direction but is busy with military trucks and Humvees. Haley resumes running again across the open ground, dodging the cholla branches that threaten to snag her. Swirling winds carry most of the smoke away from her into Mexico. What could be the source of the conflagration? Only as she draws nearer and can see above the tall brush does Haley comprehend what has occurred. Balmoray Lake, fed by San Solomon Springs and more than 500 acres in size, is on fire. Similarly to the infamous fire on Cleveland's Cuyahoga River, churning flames cover nearly the entire surface of the shallow body of water. Haley can see no sign of interventions to combat the fire. Military vehicles drive past the site without slowing. A collection of trailer homes and vacation cabins on the lake's north shore appear abandoned. But from this new vantage point, on a small knoll above the expanse, Haley can see a large gathering of military vehicles and tents amassed a couple of miles to the southeast. She starts jogging in that direction. Rounding the northern end of the Lake of Fire, Haley comes upon a white pickup truck stopped near the water's edge. The driver's door is open. A middle-aged man wearing the uniform of Texas Parks and Wildlife Department stands to one side of the vehicle, staring abjectly at the unfolding ecological catastrophe. The fire's lurid glow bathes him in a garish light. The deep lines in his face and ruddy complexion betray a life lived outdoors. As Haley draws nearer to the park ranger, she can see he is quietly sobbing.
Only after he notices her approach does the man compose himself.
Sir? Haley pauses despite her urgency. Are you okay?
The ranger, his white hair matted from his hat left on the passenger seat, gestures helplessly at the blazing lake. Words fail. Haley asks,
Why is it burning, sir? What happened here?
Comanche Corporation happened. They started developing the Alpine High Field in 2018. Found 15 billion barrels under this ground. 5 formations. Bone Springs, Wolf Camp, Barnett and Woodford, the Pennsylvanian. More than 300,000 contiguous net acres in wet gas and oil windows. In less than 2 years, they drilled 19 wells. Some sides pulling out 17,000 cubic feet of natural gas. A day. One over that hill to the east there, next to the outlet canal. After the collapse, the pandemic and such, they went bust. Just cleared out. Drill sites abandoned. Orphan wells, they call them. Leaked into the canal is what they did, see? Into the Toya Creek. Into the groundwater. San Solomon Springs. Folks around here, we tried to stop the development, to save the springs. He shakes his head. Didn't do no good. They still drilled.
Haley stares out over the lake of flame.
How did it catch fire, sir?
The park ranger shrugs, casting his gaze to his feet, humiliated.
Nobody knows. Sabotage, maybe.
Haley registers that he says this without conviction. She asks,
But can't someone do something to put it out?
National Guard won't let the county bring in the fire teams. Security risk, they said. Tried to scare me off. Fat chance. Nobody knows these back roads and trails like me. Had to come out to see for myself. Been looking after things here for close to 13 years. Taught my kids how to fish on this goddamn lake.
Just look at it now.
Haley recalls the Bible lessons delivered by her grandmother. Something about a false prophet, the mark of the beast, and a lake of fire burning with brimstone. Where and when will this hellish night end? What has been done to the world?
Everything is dead.
This from the park ranger. He has already forgotten about the young woman's intrusion on his private memorial service. Makes no effort to mask his pain.
The man is crushed. All dead, he says.
Big game hunters sought sustenance from San Solomon Springs more than 11,000 years ago. Animals have watered there for countless centuries more. First known as Mescalero Springs after the Mescalero Apache who used it as a water source, Mexican farmers rechristened the place San Solomon Springs. The canals they gouged from the dark gray, silty clay loam exist to this day. Irrigation for crops they sold to the inhabitants of Fort Davis. An abundance of water and the railroad's arrival lured a thriving cattle ranching industry. The Bureau of Reclamation power shoveled the springs in 1927 and dug an additional canal to extend the water's reach to thousands of acres of alfalfa and cotton. The Civilian Conservation Corps arrived in 1934. Roughly 200 men who constructed a 1.3-acre pool around the springs, and a concession building, bathhouses, and the surrounding Balmoray State Park. In the 1930s, troops and horses of the 1st Cavalry from Fort Bliss were the earliest visitors to camp at the new park. Tonight, more than 90 years later, elements from 36th Infantry Division 72nd Brigade of the Texas Army National Guard have made the site their base of operations. Their tents, supplies depot, and motor pool occupy nearly the park's entire 46 acres. Haley enters the camp from the east, barely winded from her jog. Encountering few soldiers at this far corner of the park, she checks her watch. It's only a few minutes past 10. Where is everybody? That question is soon answered. Drawn by the noise of a crowd, volume rising and lowering in waves, she walks south through the temporary encampment, past parked tactical vehicles and Stryker combat vehicles, until she comes to an open area. The boxing ring is a 16 by 20 foot area defined by fuel drums at each corner. Spectators form a stricter boundary, more than 100 uniformed soldiers pressing in for a better vantage point of the ongoing combat in the ring. Black faces to one side, with white and brown faces a clear majority opposite them. Two male soldiers fight in the arena, one black and one white. They wear no headgear or gloves. Stripped to their waists and barefoot, the boxers are engaged in a brutal bare-fisted slugfest. Looming over the spectacle is the Skywatch, a mobile surveillance tower, its occupants hidden from view by the large tinted windows on four sides. Haley is stunned by the fight's level of violence and the bloodlust of the onlookers. The bout is lopsided, the white fighter using an advantage in arm's length to repeatedly land jabs to his opponent's bloodied face. The deeper state operative has witnessed plenty of brawls in her childhood and in the army. She has seen the damage a sufficiently motivated sadist can inflict with a closed fist. Nothing in her personal experience, however, prepares her for the ferocity of an organized bare-knuckles fight. There is no art or sweet science, no rounds or neutral corner. Only one rule exists. The bout continues until one fighter fails to get back up. Having waged a minutes-long losing battle, the black fighter staggers and drops to his knees. There is no referee in the ring. The other soldier swings from his feet, landing an uppercut on his opponent that lifts him off the ground and puts him on his back, with arms splayed. One side is deliriously satisfied with the fight's outcome, while on the other side of the ring, silence and sullen faces result. Supporters mob the victor. Black soldiers tend to their fallen comrade. He is soon back on his feet, badly bloodied but ambulatory. Haley turns to address a white female corporal standing next to her in the crowd of riotous spectators. "What is all of this?" she asks. "Brigade tradition, at least as long as I've been around. Last Friday of every month. That's how it got its name, Last Friday Fights. Back in Austin, this is the biggest underground draw in town."
"Well deployed?"
The corporal smirks. "This bullshit mission? Give me a break. We're jacking off out here with nothing to do." She shrugs. "The major wanted last Friday, whether deployed or not."
"Major Nathaniel Culberson?"
The female corporal sizes Haley up. "Who are you, anyway? You're ARNG, right?" she asks, using the acronym for Army National Guard.
"He's here? The major?"
Realizing she's said too much to someone who might be an outsider, the corporal slides a telltale glance over her right shoulder, up at the Skywatch Tower. Following her gaze, Haley sees the bout's winner climbing a set of external stairs up to the mobile guard tower. To be congratulated by the event's VIP attendees? A phalanx of guardsmen prevents intruders from following their champion to that lofty perch. When Haley lowers her gaze, she discovers the corporal has skulked off. Another fight is about to commence, one combatant already having entered the arena. The deeper state operative regards the soldier waiting for her opponent to join her on the patch of oil and blood-soaked dirt. She is a giant of a woman, Hispanic with close-cropped black hair and wearing ACU pants and a filthy T-shirt. The long shape of her head and narrowly spaced eyes suggests a praying mantis, enough so at least to have earned the nickname her supporters repeatedly call out.
"Mantis religiosa! Mantis religiosa!"
With sinewy biceps and ham hocks for fists, she is the white and Hispanic soldiers' favorite. Haley scans the side of the ring, where the black soldiers have closed ranks around their next fighter. She is also tall, almost 6 feet, and solidly proportioned. Athleticism isn't a problem. The black soldier, wearing ACU pants and a military sand T-shirt, would intimidate most opponents with the sheer menace of her powerful physique. At issue is her head. Like everyone else in the crowd of spectators, she watched the destruction of the last fighter. In addition to the jeers of the white and brown spectators, that punishment had an unnerving effect. Mantis religiosa has that kind of Mike Tyson effect. Her reputation as a brawling, relentless assassin precedes her. The prospect of a bloody fracas between women has driven the crowd into a frenzy, one that only intensifies when the white and Latino spectators register the black fighter's reluctance to enter the ring. Those spectators release an avalanche of ridicule and obscenities on the woman, encouraged by Mantis Religiosa, whose derision takes flight in a rapid-fire mix of Spanish and English. The black fighter recoils as her supporters on that side of the ring nevertheless push her forward into the ring. Haley glances up at the Skywatch box, anticipating some reaction or intervention. None is forthcoming. The tinted windows hide the VIP spectators from view, silent and accusatory. The deeper state operative sees no movement behind the tower's windows. The door remains closed. She pushes through the crowd and enters the ring.
I'll do it!
At first, no one in the crowd pays Haley any mind. Their clamor too distracted. She crosses the makeshift arena and stands in front of the black fighter, blocking her way forward.
I'll fight her, she says to the other woman.
Once the spectators comprehend Haley's intention, their scorn rises to an even higher pitch. The deeper state operative is nearly a foot shorter than the Hispanic fighter and 30 pounds lighter. Wearing light cotton pants, long-sleeved shirt, and sensible flats, Haley hardly presents herself as a ready fighter. The black boxer resents what she perceives as pity. Her eyes blaze.
Don't need you fighting for me.
Haley is unwavering.
You can't fight scared. She'll maul you. Scared never wins.
They can hardly hear each other over the howling mob, but Haley's words sink in with the black fighter, pushing their way past her pride and humiliation, and landing. She is scared. The black fighter turns abruptly and disappears into the crowd behind her. One of the black soldiers stares angrily at Haley, rebelling against the white woman's intrusion.
Not really the idea, if you know what I mean.
The tone of her voice isn't friendly. What is the idea? Haley asks. No response comes quickly enough to stop her from slipping off her shoes. Someone in the back of the crowd throws a dirty t-shirt forward. Haley catches it on the fly and looks hard into the eyes of the soldier who had spoken. Understanding what is needed, the female guardsman steps forward, close to Haley, who quickly unbuttons her shirt. The crowd roars in approval over what they view as libidinous performance. Only her back is revealed to the mob as she removes her shirt, tosses it to the ground, and pulls on the t-shirt. Turning then, dressed for the combat, Haley faces her opponent. She does not consider herself a savior. The deeper state operative has one goal. Win, and climb the stairs to the Skywatch box, to earn an audience with Nathaniel Culberson. She has fought with only her fists more times than she can count. As a kid growing up in Lincoln County, West Virginia, while an amateur boxer in the U.S. Army, in backyards, street alleys, and recreational halls, Haley has the necessary skills to punish an opponent into submission. Yet, despite this multitude of scraps, no previous bout seems more significant than the one she now faces. There is no bell or facsimile of one. The moment both fighters in the ring toe their respective lines scratched in the dirt signifies the bout's start. Haley's adversary is ready. Mantis Religiosa watches Haley with cold, Tyson-like menace, devoid of emotion. Waiting for the moment, primed to strike. Haley is warmed up from her two runs, from town to the lake, and then to the ARNG site at Balmoray State Park. But one crucial element is missing. Before every fight as an amateur, she would clench a jagged, walnut-sized rock in her hand so fiercely as to bring blood. After that private ritual was completed, Haley knew she was ready. There was nothing to fear. Blood was drawn. She could fight. With the crowd screaming for the start of the bout, Haley turns her back on her opponent. Many of the spectators believe she has lost her nerve, the same as the first fighter. But the deeper state operative doesn't leave the ring. Instead, she beckons the same female soldier who had challenged her decision to fight.
Hit me! Haley says to her, shouting over the crowd noise. Come again? Hit me!
She points at her face.
Hit me hard!
The female soldier, raised in a neighborhood south of downtown Houston ranked as one of the most dangerous in the entire nation, doesn't need to be asked twice.
Fuck yeah!
The soldier pulls back her right elbow and bops Haley in the nose. Blood immediately pours from Haley's left nostril. She puts her fingers to the blood and nods, satisfied. There is nothing to fear. Blood flows. Now I can fight. Haley turns and charges forward. Before the Hispanic fighter has time to cover, she connects with a rock-solid left hook. Mantis Religiosa, stunned by the blow, is temporarily incapacitated. Time ceases to exist, and the crowd's clamoring fills her ears. Brain functions are on the fritz. Mantis Religiosa puts the deeper state operative in a clinch to save herself. Haley pushes her opponent off and charges forward again. The Hispanic fighter backpedals into the surrounding crowd. Spectators propel Mantis Religiosa, unused to being on the defensive, forward again. Haley traps her just inside the ring's perimeter and throws a rocketing left uppercut that is followed immediately by a thundering right to the body. The right jab is a finisher. For the first time in her fighting career, whether in a sanctioned amateur bout or a similar illegal fight like tonight's, Mantis Religiosa takes a knee. Haley steps back away from her adversary, unwilling to press her attack despite an obvious no-rules situation. Ridicule and obscene mockery fall on the champion in a deluge of verbal abuse. Her supporters are in a riot over their fighter's apparent surrender. Mantis Religiosa's pride wins the internal conflict with her sense of self-preservation. After 5 seconds on her knee, the Hispanic fighter stands again and goes on the attack. Haley is ready for the swinging right hand and ducks under it, answering with a sharp left-right combination to her opponent's cheek. Mantis Religiosa crumples to the ground, knocked out. She failed to connect with a single punch. In contrast to the remainder of the crowd's sullen and stunned silence, the black spectators celebrate Haley's shocking victory. The deeper state operative checks her hands for broken bones. The fight lasted less than 90 seconds. Her jog from the lake was a greater exertion. Standing at the center of the crude boxing ring, Haley glances up at the expressionless, tinted windows of the skywatch. The door of the tower box opens and a soldier scuttles out, coming down the stairs and gesturing to the crowd to make way for their new champion, the vanquisher of Mantis Religiosa, for Haley Chill. Watching her fight, he was almost sure the young woman in the ersatz boxing ring below was the same person he saw with investigators at the New Mexico compound. With his powerful binoculars, he had committed her features to memory. The only woman in the scrum of investigators was difficult to forget. For Oswald, watching her demolition of the Hispanic boxer was unsurprising. Once he recognized her and witnessed the ease with which she commanded the boxing ring, Oswald knew who would be victorious. His father had been a true aficionado of the sport. Both he and his dad were enormous fans of Cassius Clay, not ever referred to by them as Muhammad Ali. Though that champion's politics made it almost impossible to acknowledge his support in public. The fights with Frazier, though, swept aside any disapproval 8-year-old Pete Oswald inherited from his dad of Clay's activist beliefs. And the bout against Foreman and Zaire? My God, that was boxing. The way this blonde fighter moved in the ring suggested just a hint of that poise and speed. But now isn't the time or the place to rekindle childhood passions. Oswald hasn't watched a full bout of professional boxing in more than a decade. He had come to Balmoray to assess Culberson's performance and capabilities. A civilian's shooting death at the hands of Texas Army National Guard personnel brought unwanted media attention at a particularly sensitive phase of the operation. That incident and the shootout at the New Mexico compound have raised concerns. 0 hour nears. The storm's goals are on the cusp of becoming something much more than a pipe dream. Every operational element of the conspiracy must avoid further mishaps. Which is why Oswald argued strenuously with the Major to cancel this ridiculous event. To no avail. A born narcissist and preening military man, Culberson had flatly refused to listen to reason. And now this. When the young woman is ushered into the tower box to meet the Major, Pete Oswald knows her plan with absolute certainty.
So she has come this far in her investigation, this high in our chain of command.
Then a second, even more shocking realization.
She was involved in Libby's untimely demise.
Oswald stands at the rear of the box behind three seats that afford the best view. As she enters, the young woman's eyes fall on the Major and his aides. He pretends to check his phone for messages, turning his face away in the unlikely event she is able to connect him with the incident in New Mexico. Pete Oswald can't help but be impressed by her cunning and persistence, defeating the Hispanic fighter to win an audience with Culberson. Without a doubt, her investigation represents the gravest threat to their effort.
She must be destroyed.
Major Nathaniel Culberson sits in a swivel chair at the big window that affords a generous vantage point over the surrounding area below. Like the two junior National Guard officers seated on either side of him, he wears his combat uniform and is identifiable by rank insignia at the center of his jacket and name tape above the right pocket. Having established Culberson's presence, Haley shifts her focus to the man in civilian clothing. Black khaki pants and button-down shirt, and with a bit of a paunch, engrossed with a phone call at the back of the tower box. She senses that he is avoiding her gaze. Why is he acting so weird? Where have they met before?
Outstanding performance, young lady, says the Major. That was quite a show you put on.
Culberson had stood upon Haley's arrival and now offers his hand to shake. The deeper state operative swings her attention off the man in black civilian clothing and accepts the Major's hand. Thank you, sir.
You've obviously had experience in the ring. The benefit of professional instruction. What's your name? Where have you fought?
Haley Chill, Major. Before leaving the Army, I was stationed at Fort Hood. Culberson's face lights up with recognition.
Chill! You fought Marcella Rivas a few years back.
He addresses his two aides excitedly, gesturing toward Haley.
Beat a 2-time Golden Gloves champ with the first armored. Come from behind, KO.
Yes, sir. Rivas is a good fighter.
But not good enough. Not that night.
Haley nods. Her nose hurts like hell where she took the ritualistic punch just prior to the bout. The dried blood inside her nostrils makes it difficult to breathe except through her mouth. She can't remember the last time she slept for more than a few hours. Without looking his way, Haley feels the eyes of the civilian standing behind Culberson on her now, sizing her up. Why? Who is he?
The Major asks, What I want to know, however, is what the hell you're doing here in my camp?
The mood in the cramped confines of the guard tower shifts abruptly. The easy grin has disappeared from the Major's face. She clocked the Sig Sauer P320 handgun on the narrow shelf in front of Culberson upon entering the tower a few moments earlier. The guardsmen who stand sentry at the bottom of the stairs haven't gone anywhere. Should she require escape, her options are limited. I'm in Texas on behalf of Senator Gordon Powell and the Senate Armed Services Committee. The senator and many of his colleagues have become concerned, Major, about reports of white supremacy within the U.S. military. At all levels, sir. Culberson doesn't so much as flinch, absorbing Haley's direct challenge without overt reaction. His face is immobile, with eyes that seem without a bottom, twin pinholes that empty into a corrupted, pitiless soul.
You didn't have to whip ass on one of the brigade's best fighters to get a meeting with me, Ms. Chill. That's why God and the Pentagon created public affairs representatives.
Precisely, sir.
Then what the actual fuck did you hope to gain by confronting me directly?
Haley glances toward the man in black who no longer feigns interest in his smartphone. His seeming recognition of her and his blatant predatory stare, lacking any other plausible explanation, incontrovertibly designate him as another player in the game. The first place her mind goes is the ridgeline above the New Mexico compound and the road out. Someone watching them, standing on the rise above. The occasional sun flare off what must have been binoculars, and dressed all in black, just like here. He is a person of interest, a factor to be considered, but not now. At this charged moment, Nathaniel Culberson is her target. His role in the unnamed conspiracy. What he might know about her father and how he was involved. Haley turns her gaze to the major again.
Sir, what do you know about the participation by members of the U.S. military in the recent incidents of sabotage in the Permian Basin?
His voice rises an octave with mock incredulity.
The sabotage we've been deployed to prevent?
What about the storm, Major?
The Major guffaws and exchanges a dubious look with one of his aides.
Before Culberson can frame his response, they all hear the altercation from down below. In Houston, on August 23, 1917, black soldiers guarding the construction of Camp Logan fought city police and local residents in a series of pitched gun battles that lasted hours. The arrest of a black soldier for allegedly interfering in the detention of a black woman ignited the riot. 16 white city residents died, including 5 police officers. 4 black soldiers were killed. Martial law eventually restored order to the city after a full day of chaos. 64 black soldiers were tried in the subsequent court-martial, the largest in U.S. military history. 13 were found guilty of murder and hanged, without the chance to appeal. On Guam, Christmas Day, 1944, white and black soldiers fired on one another with their service weapons in a quarrel that began the day before over a Chamorro woman. Tensions had been rising between the two groups on the island, taken from the Japanese army 6 months earlier, at the cost of almost 2,000 American lives, after a series of racially charged incidents. A violent disturbance occurred at Camp Lejeune on July 20, 1969, the night Neil Armstrong first set foot on the moon, when a black Marine tried to cut into a white Marine dancing with a black female Marine at the NCO club. The 20-year-old white corporal, Edward Bankston, who survived multiple combat-related injuries in Vietnam, was beaten to death. In October 1972, black and white sailors armed with broom handles, wrenches, and pieces of pipe fought one another aboard the U.S. carrier Kitty Hawk. 50 sailors were evacuated to onshore hospitals. The chaos began when a black sailor requested 2 sandwiches from an unreceptive white cook. A shouting match ensued after the black sailor reached across the food service line and took 2 sandwiches anyway. With 4,500 sailors aboard and only 302 of them black, the ship was a racial tinderbox, due in no small part to the civil rights movement going on at the time back home. The fighting at the National Guard encampment between black and white soldiers erupts over an unpaid bet. Passions had already been stirred, of course, by the racially demarcated bare-knuckle bouts that led up to the altercation. Pushing and shoving leads to a thrown punch. Initially, the scuffle is limited to the 2 original combatants. With the white soldier losing to his black adversary, other white and brown soldiers jump to his defense. A free-for-all ensues. Fortunately, the risk of gunplay in the escalating fracas is limited. After the accidental shooting of the local resident earlier in the week, officers confiscated most, if not all, ammunition. Improvised weapons, however, are quickly taken up as the situation spirals out of control. Haley emerges from the surveillance tower and descends the external stairway, following Major Culberson and the 2 junior officers. The violent brawl swirls around them. Military police are nowhere to be seen. Culberson, the senior officer on site, raises his arms and tries to be heard over the mob.
Stop! Stop fighting, goddammit!
No one pays him any mind. The fracas intensifies. Officers try to control the soldiers to little or no effect. Many combatants have armed themselves with lengths of pipe, wooden stakes, and glass bottles. These improvised weapons inflict terrible, bloody injuries. Haley sees Culberson give up and retreat from the chaos. Needing to question him, she starts after the major, but is stopped by a group of frenzied soldiers who recognize her as the winner of the last fight. They block her path, converging on her. Haley strikes out at her attackers, deflecting their blows, but there are too many of them. Knocked to the ground, she draws her knees to her head, protecting her face and abdomen from their kicks and punches. One soldier stands over her with a length of pipe, poised to slam it on her skull. Haley sees the blow coming out of the corner of her eye and braces for it. There's nowhere to go. Nothing to be done. Too many of them. but the jolt never comes. When she uncovers her head, Haley sees that several Reeves County Sheriff's personnel have waded into the crowd and are in the process of restoring order. The same deputy she spoke with briefly at the Tex-Mex joint in Sierra Blanco disarmed the soldier who was moments from attacking her with a pipe.
I guess you could say it's about civilization. The fake kind we see all around us, and the one that's real.
Deputy Jay Gibbs puts cuffs on Haley's would-be attacker. The deeper state operative gets to her feet without anyone's help. From her new perspective on the scene, she sees the Reeves County Sheriff prowlers stopped just outside the scrum of soldiers, LED light bars flashing. With cooler heads on both sides prevailing, altercations between the National Guard troops have mostly ended. Several soldiers remain down on the ground, bleeding from various injuries, but alive. Gibbs toggles his radio as another deputy takes control of the handcuffed soldier.
We're gonna need EMT response.
Once that's done, he turns his attention to the blonde woman with the powder blue eyes.
He didn't realize it was her at first. Seeing the soldier raising the pipe to strike someone, just another body down on the ground, Gibbs moved quickly to stop the attack. But once he had immobilized the frenzied soldier, the deputy recognized his victim.
Her?
How often does anything like that ever happen?
They had exchanged a few words at Delfina's only an hour or so earlier, and then she left. Out of his life forever, or so he imagined at the time. Gibbs thought about the woman on the rest of the drive home after his meal. Like a love-addled school kid, he daydreamed of various scenarios in which he might run into her again. Helping her out with a flat tire, seeing her at the local Family Dollar store, or when he stopped in for a cold beer at Papa Top after his shift. In his mind's eye, the sheriff's deputy saw how that scene would play out, pretty much in its entirety. The mild surprise and bashful grins. An offer to join her at the bar. He would buy the next round and she would tease him about being a cop. He would tell her about his writerly aspirations and a thinly veiled attempt to gain her interest. The radio call requesting immediate assistance with a disturbance at the National Guard's temporary camp at Balmoray State Park cut short these idle fantasies. He was on Interstate 10 less than 5 minutes from the scene, having avoided construction on the more direct route. Had he taken his usual route up Interstate 20, Gibbs would have missed out.
He would never have seen her. Not ever again.
Haley doesn't know where her tote bag is, or her shoes and shirt. Wearing her scuffed linen pants and dirty t-shirt, barefoot and aching from the blows she took to her side, hips, and back, she wonders where Culberson has fled. She didn't go through everything she has in the past 6 hours, the long drive from El Paso, detained by the National Guard troops on the highway, slipping away from the high school, her run to the burning lake, and finally winning a bare-knuckles bout to gain an audience with the major, only to lose him so easily. Looking in all directions for Culberson, Haley finally registers that her rescuer is speaking to her.
Ma'am, are you okay? He asks for the third time.
The deeper state operative finally locks her eyes on Gibbs. Yes, thank you. Not acknowledging, she recognizes him from the Tex-Mex place. No time for that now.
You sure? Look a bit beat up there.
Haley's mind is elsewhere. She realizes the solicitous deputy might be useful to her cause.
Major Culberson. He's the senior officer in camp.
The sheriff's deputy needs to be sure he understands what Haley is saying.
He...
Culberson organized the bare-knuckle boxing matches, deputy. He's responsible for all of this.
What bare-knuckle boxing matches?
Jay Gibbs has experienced much in his 32 years, growing up in hardscrabble West Texas, tours in Afghanistan and Iraq, patrolling highways on the front lines of the drug war. But when Haley gives him a sharp look the likes of which he has never experienced, his knees could buckle. He toggles his radio.
Anybody see a major trying to get on out of here? Stop him for questioning.
Thank you, she says. Gibbs nods and taps the brim of his straw resistol.
Ma'am?
The black female soldier who bopped her in the nose at Haley's behest approaches, carrying the deeper state operative's personal belongings, shoes, shirt, and tote bag. Grateful, Haley accepts her things.
Are you okay?
She asks the soldier. The woman is unsmiling.
Lady, we're a long way from okay.
Haley says nothing. She can't disagree. She clocks the UH-60 Black Hawk helicopter approaching from the west, swooping overhead and landing in the open area between the National Guard camp and the diversion canal, meaning Haley only has a few minutes to question Culberson without Pogue's interference. Jay Gibbs has proved himself to be of invaluable assistance. The National Guard major was stopped by Reeves County Sheriff's deputies at the interstate on-ramp heading east, back to Austin, presumably. He hadn't accepted his detainment in good humor. Only a stern phone call from the governor himself, Deputy Gibbs again, was enough to shut down Culberson's protestations and guarantee his cooperation with local law enforcement. Overhead halogens illuminating their walk to the sheriff's department SUV stopped near the park's entrance off State Highway 17. Haley glances to her left, to Gibbs, as they approach the vehicle where Culberson is being held. Despite the circumstances, the litany of promises she had made to herself not to have such thoughts, she can't help but admire the cut of his profile in the half-light. Haley recognizes the attention he's given her can't be entirely official, and has to remind herself, again, for the umpteenth time, "Not now, idiot. Not now." As they near the SUV, Gibbs says,
"The man isn't overjoyed with the situation such as it is."
Two other sheriff's deputies stand guard outside. Haley nods.
"Such as it is."
He asks,
"You want me?"
"I'll be fine, deputy. Thank you."
Gibbs's grin is as wrinkled as his department-issued khaki shirt. He had taken care to put on a freshly laundered, adequately ironed shirt in the morning for his court appearance, but that was a lifetime ago. Enough has transpired in the last 16 hours to make a wreck of his best efforts at a button-down presentability.
"Yeah, I'm pretty sure you will be."
One of the deputies regards Haley skeptically as they walk up to the parked vehicle.
"Who's she?"
he asks Gibbs.
"Not your business, Slick."
He opens the front passenger side door for Haley.
"That's who."
Haley says,
"Thank you again, Deputy Gibbs."
She climbs into the SUV, the sheriff's deputy closing the door behind her. Nathaniel Culberson sits in the back seat, sufficiently caged behind wire mesh cargo and side window barriers. Haley in front turns to face him, her left elbow resting on the seat back. "Hello, Major." His ego is bruised, and he's scared, frantic for a way out.
"Satisfied? We were only having a little fun, working off some stress."
"The five soldiers in your command that were sent to the hospital are the least of your problems, sir." Culberson shrugs, a poor attempt at feigning a cavalier attitude. "Did you know a Charles Hicks, Major? Former Marine who worked at the Pentagon? Or Tommy Chill?" He seems offended by her presence, by her persistent harangue.
"You have no rights here, no jurisdiction, nor do these deputies."
"Captain Christian Libby gave you up, sir, before jumping from the roof of the William Beaumont Army Medical Center to his death." Mere mention of the captain's name takes Culberson's legs out from underneath him.
"Libby?"
"Yes, sir." He processes these revelations, understands now the meaning of the phrase, "walls closing in." Haley asks, "Who's involved, Major? What's the plan, the goals of your group?"
"Group?"
"Yes, sir." She takes a stab in the dark. "The storm." He grins, his eyes watery and vague. Haley wonders if he is under the influence of drugs.
"It's not too late, Major. There are other ways out than the one taken by Captain Libby."
Culberson seems to mentally shift gears, giving his interrogator a quizzical look. He says,
"Tommy Chill."
Haley can't not react.
"Sir?"
"You asked me a minute ago about Tommy Chill."
She feels as if her heart might thump its way out of her chest.
Glancing out the windshield, the deeper state operative sees CID agents Roy Pogue and Angelica Lopez approaching from the road leading into the temporary garrison.
A clutch of somber-looking National Guard officers accompany them. Haley turns her focus on Culberson again. She estimates she has less than a minute. What do you know about Tommy Chill, Major?
Your father?
Haley remembers using her real name with Culberson when she entered the guard tower.
Fucking stupid.
Yes, he was my father. Culberson smirks.
Well, Tommy, he was more than a footnote.
Sir? She can hear their voices outside the car. Gibbs trying to buy her more time.
The guy in charge? Our George Washington? He and Tommy were like this,
he says, wrapping his two index fingers. One of the rear doors is pulled open. Pogue peers inside the SUV, seeing both Culberson and Haley.
Miss Chill.
Pogue knew Haley was on site. As her contact at Fort Bliss, he was summoned to the location because of her involvement in the incident. But the CID agent hoped not to find her questioning the National Guard officer before Criminal Investigation Command. In fact, nothing would please him more than to see her on a plane to Washington, D.C.
Chief, says Haley, in that chill way.
Pogue and Lopez walk Culberson through camp to the open ground on the opposite side of the state park. The major suffers every step of that forced march, in full display before the troops in his command. Haley, a few paces behind him, can almost see the humiliation and dread shed off the senior officer like a fever sweat. Midnight has come and gone. With a cooling trend in the offing, temperatures hover in the low 70s. The late night's weather could be described as pleasant, except for the fire's smoke drifting from the east. Her work isn't over, not by a long shot. Haley Chill can barely recall how the day began. As they approach the waiting chopper that will take Culberson to Fort Bliss, she sees the man in black from the guard tower, standing in the back of a silent crowd of soldiers. But in the blink of an eye, he disappears from view. Had she seen him? Who is he? That the man is connected in some way to the conspiracy, the storm, is certain. Haley considers her initial hunch that he is the same individual she spied standing on the ridge at the New Mexico compound. Now that she has seen him up close, the deeper state operative has committed his features to memory. The CID agents prepare to load Culberson into the Blackhawk. He hesitates, wanting a word with Haley.
Get in the chopper, sir, Pogue orders, keeping a firm grip on the major's arm.
The National Guard major turns to Haley, leaning toward her in a last-ditch attempt for private conversation.
Three words,
sir.
Clemency. Witness protection.
His gaze has an unhinged intensity.
Believe me, whoever you really work for wants to hear what I've got to say.
Pogue shoves Culberson toward the open doorway in the side of the helicopter.
Now, Major, hop in.
The detainee climbs aboard, followed by Lopez. Twin General Electric T-700 turboshaft engines turn over and roar to a start. The chopper's four-blade main rotor begins to turn. Pogue pauses before joining the others inside the Blackhawk.
Sure you wouldn't prefer riding back with us? I can have one of the MPs here sort out your vehicle.
Haley shakes her head. I'll be okay, sir. See you back at Fort Bliss? 1000 hours? The CID agent is anxious to be off.
You got it.
Within seconds of Pogue climbing aboard and pulling the chopper's hatch closed, the Black Hawk lifts off and flies west. She checks her watch. 5 minutes past 2 a.m. Having spent the last 2 hours interviewing both ARNG enlisted personnel and officers at the temporary garrison in Balmoray, Haley is satisfied that awareness of the storm and its agenda is limited. As best as she's been able to ascertain, only Culberson is involved. The two junior officers Haley found in the guard tower with the major will be questioned further by CID, but only regarding their role in the bare-knuckle brawls organized by their superior officer. For the time being, Haley is withholding any details of the storm from the Army's Criminal Investigation Command. No one Haley interviews seems to know the identity of the man in black or where he might have gone. Gibbs stands at the open driver's side window of the rental car parked on the interstate's overpass, where Haley had left it hours earlier. Behind the wheel, the deeper state operative wishes she could just stop and rest, wake up after a decent amount of sleep and meet the deputy someplace for breakfast, drink a cup of coffee, talk about books, the weather, about anything but the darkness that infuses her every waking thought, a growing sense of dread. But that is only fantasy. Haley has the long drive back to El Paso. She needs to make calls regarding Culberson's demands for clemency and wonders who in Andrew Wilde's Rolodex will be able to swing it. Other business requires Haley's attention, too, before she can steal an hour or two of sleep.
Personally, I think it's not too smart driving back at this hour of the night. Some of the things I've seen on this road after midnight you wouldn't believe.
Gibbs only just met Haley Chill, but already has her measure. He knows he's wasting perfectly good oxygen with these words. She smiles wearily, grateful as a person can be for his friendly offer of help. Deputy Gibbs, Jay, I appreciate your assistance tonight.
Assistance.
He nods and taps the brim of his hat.
Next time, try them gorditas.
I will, says Haley. Maybe you can join me. Jay Gibbs strives to keep his grin under wraps, and mostly fails.
Oswald drives north on Ranch Road, takes the interstate west to the next exit, and doubles back, pulling over to the shoulder so he has a decent vantage point on the overpass. He passed several cars parked there and found the blue-eyed woman's rental vehicle among them, having committed the make, color, and model to memory when he observed it at the New Mexico compound. He switches off the engine and kills the lights. His binoculars are on the seat next to him. All he has to do now is wait. He argued strenuously with Culberson to cancel the bare knuckles event. All of this unnecessary attention. Oswald dreads making his report to the storm's ideological leader. James Earl Woodside is an unforgiving man with a hyperbolic temper. The best strategy is to deliver the unvarnished truth. Embellishing or spinning a false representation of events only made matters worse. Oswald knows this from experience. Another man, a member of the inner circle like him, with oversight on several elements of the movement simultaneously, attempted to cover up his failure by shifting responsibility to others. Woodside exposed the falsehood easily enough and summoned the man for a late-night meeting. Faced with a more dire fate, the shamed conspirator performed seppuku, with the broad elements of that Japanese ritual of honor suicide observed, down to the cloth-wrapped tanto, spectators, and the traditional left-to-right cutting open of the abdomen. That night, less than 2 weeks ago, Oswald was more than convinced James Woodside meant business. The offender's honor suicide had the desired impact. Message received, loud and clear. Their cause was do or die. No half measures would be tolerated. Surrender was not an option. Under Woodside's leadership and by dint of his sheer willpower, the movement would go forward and achieve its stated goals. Or they will all die trying. Oswald first met the movement's leader in Iraq. The war was how many of the organization's core members had met, had their eyes opened to the truth of what had become of America. The corruption of its founding fathers' ideals.
And most important, shown them a path to starting over.
Most of these original conspirators have since left the military, though a valuable contingent remains with combat forces. No one in the movement is higher in its rigid hierarchy than Woodside. The movement is Woodside. He has led them to within sight of the promised land. He is their new founding father. Pete Oswald, one of Woodside's first acolytes, has been a fervent and devoted servant of their ideological leader. He has served as a kind of factotum for the congressman, willing and able to fulfill any need, complete any mission no matter what. His high rank in the organization and unshakable faith in its cause have given Oswald a reason to live.
the storm, in almost every way possible, has become his life. He will make a full and accurate report of what happened here in Balmoray and accept his fate. After waiting nearly an hour, Oswald sees a sheriff's department SUV stop on the overpass and the young blonde woman get out. She speaks to the deputy behind the wheel briefly, and then walks to her car parked on the side of the road just short of the overpass. He watches with his binoculars as she pulls away from the shoulder and takes the on-ramp for the westbound interstate. Once she has entered the highway and attained cruising speed, Oswald hits the ignition and merges onto the mostly deserted interstate. He takes the off-ramp for Balmoray, crosses the same overpass, and turns for the westbound on-ramp. He doesn't know where the Senate 8 is going, but he sure as hell wants to find out.